WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Gregory Howard Williams, has a unique perspective on race in America. He spent part of his life as a white person, part of it as an African American. Until he was 10, he lived a middle-class life in Virginia with his parents, who he believed were white. Then his mother walked out on the family business fell apart, and his father told him the truth. Gregory's father was really a light-skinned black who was passing for white. After the divorce, when Gregory's father was in debt and drinking too much, he took Gregory and his brother Mike to live with poor black relatives in the slums of Muncie, Indiana. From that time on, Gregory lived as an African American. Gregory Williams is now the dean of the Ohio State University College of Law. He's written a new memoir called Life on the Color Line. I asked him to read the passage after he learns that his father is black.
I didn't understand, Dad. I knew I wasn't colored, and neither was he. My skin was white. All of us are white, I said to myself. But for the first time, I had to admit Dad didn't exactly look white. His deeply tanned skin puzzled me as I sat there trying to classify my own father. Goosebumps covered my arms as I realized that whatever he was, I was. I took a deep breath. I couldn't make any mistakes. I looked closer. His heavy lips and dark brown eyes didn't make him colored, I concluded. His black wavy hair was different from Negro's hair, but it was different from most white folks' hair, too. He was darker than most whites, but Mom said he was Italian. That was why my baby brother had such dark skin and curly hair. Mom told us to be proud of our Italian heritage. That's it, I decided. He was Italian. I leaned back against the seat, satisfied. Yet the unsettling image of Miss Sally flashed before me like a neon sign. Colored, colored, colored. He continued, "Life is going to be different from now on. In Virginia, you are white boys. In Indiana, you're going to be colored boys. I want you to remember that you're the same today that you were yesterday, but people in Indiana will treat you differently."
When your father told you that life is going to be different now and people would treat you differently, what was your impression of what it meant to be black? What had you seen that made the biggest impression on you?
Up until age 10, we had lived in kind of a privileged existence in Virginia. My father had a restaurant and beer tavern, was masquerading as a white man there. I went to whites-only swimming pools, whites-only skating rinks, whites-only schools, and I saw that I really had a very different life than my black playmates who lived near us near the restaurant, because I had visited some of their schools, and those schools were not the same quality in terms of physical facilities that I had attended in Virginia. And so when we went back to Indiana, I knew, based on that Virginia experience, that there were going to be a lot of doors that were going to be closed to me if I was black.
Did you want to protest and say, "Look at me, no, I'm not black, somebody's made a terrible mistake"?
Absolutely. I looked at that and I said, this can't be true. It's absolutely impossible. I'd never heard anything crazier in my life. And I resisted it and didn't believe it and didn't believe that my dad was telling me the truth and was angry about it. But the more he talked about it, the more I realized that he was telling the truth and that our lives were going to be different if Virginia or if Indiana was anything like Virginia.
When you got to Indiana, your father took you to live with your Aunt Bessie. And then when she didn't want to take care of you, you were given to your grandmother. Your grandmother had actually worked at your parents' tavern. I guess your father was afraid that if he admitted she was his mother and didn't just call her an employee, he wouldn't be able to pass.
Right.
I mean, you didn't even know she was your grandmother. You thought she was just the help when she worked there.
Right. When she had kind of mysteriously drifted in and out of our lives a number of times, and she was always introduced to me as Miss Sally, the maid or the cook or whatever. And that's what I thought she was, because that's the way she had been identified to me. But my father really had to ignore her and not recognize her as his mother if he was going to be able to continue his charade of passing in Virginia. And that was something that was kept from my brother and the rest of us.
So when you actually went to live with her, was she pretty resentful of how the family had treated her?
Oh, she was very resentful. She was resentful of the fact that my father had ignored her and that her own little grandchildren had ignored her and, were calling her Miss Sally instead of grandmother. And she was very, very bitter about the treatment that she had received, and rightfully so, because she had not been acknowledged as being related to my family at all. And when we were back in Muncie, to some extent, I think she relished the fact that my father had failed in his efforts to pass as white and be as successful as he had wanted to be.
Why did your father want to pass?
I think it was largely an economic decision, as it is for many people who pass for white. In Virginia, I remember in the early 50s, my father was enormously successful, and I remember seeing a tax return where he had a gross income of over $50,000. When we returned to Muncie, Indiana, he never had a job in which he made more than $50 a week. And so it was economic. There was an economic incentive to be white. However, he didn't realize that there was more to life than economics, and that there was a pretty heavy price he had to pay for trying to be white, even though he did receive tremendous economic success, or achieve tremendous economic success.
So when your mother left the family, your father gave up passing for white?
Well, he tried to continue the business for a while, but his drinking got worse and worse, and the business pretty much ended. He was able to get a job at the Pentagon as security guard for a while, but the drinking got worse and worse. He couldn't handle the business by himself, and he pretty much was a defeated man after my mother left. And so we just struggled on in Virginia for about, another 6-7 months before everything just totally disintegrated.
So when your father first took you to live with relatives, what were some of the immediate ways in which your life changed, your neighborhood, the house, the way people saw you?
Well, we had visited my white grandparents who lived in Muncie over the summers and holidays for a number of years. And every time we would go to Muncie to visit them, we would go into a nice suburban community. When we got off the bus after the family had disintegrated and left the bus station, we walked down South Walnut Street and then down the railroad. And that was a view of Muncie that I'd never, ever seen before. We found ourselves in the middle of the black housing projects and in the black area of Muncie where buildings were falling down and that everything was in disrepair. And I, for the first time, saw a view of Muncie that was absolutely foreign to me. And that was my first indication that life was, in fact, going to be very different. Then actually we started to elementary school, and I didn't think I was going to be treated differently in school, but I quickly found out that I was going to be treated differently.
How were you treated differently?
Well, once my heritage was discovered, I did make some initial friends with some of the white students, and I remember one particular case, there was two girls, white girls, who I became very friendly with that first week of school, and I was trying to kind of reach out and make friends and that type of thing, and we had a really great conversation. They knew that I was from Washington, D.C., and I'd been to the Washington Monument and been to Mount Vernon, places like that, and was able to explain all that to them. But then one afternoon, apparently they discovered that I was black, and from that time on, they never, ever spoke to me again. And that was my first real indication that I was, in fact, going to be treated differently.
What about black children in school? Did they accept you as black even though you looked white?
Well, my brother and I found ourselves up on the Black Housing Project's playground in Muncie, and of course everybody around there wondered, who are these two little white boys? And my brother and I had a lot of fights because people wonder who we were, what the hell we were doing there, and that it wasn't until we met our other black cousins and then that support group that we finally began to be accepted on the playgrounds and in the community. But it was a while before we were accepted.
What was most foreign to you about the culture that you are now a part of?
Well, the poverty, actually. We had had a very, very upper class or upper middle class existence in Virginia, and in Indiana, we had absolutely nothing. My grandmother worked as a cook for about 50 cents an hour, and the only way that we were able to eat was what she was able to, I guess, steal from the restaurant. She would usually slip a hamburger patty or a few French fries in her pocketbook that she would take out of the restaurant at night. And so we went from having everything to having absolutely nothing and just pretty much living at a starvation level.
After staying with your grandmother a while, you were taken in by a woman named Miss Dora, who virtually became your mother. Tell us something about her, who she was, and why she took you in.
Well, she had been a friend of the family for a long time. In, I guess, the 30s, her husband was a gambler and a bootlegger and had a reputation of, I guess, kind of in that world in Muncie. But he had died, and she had become a very religious woman. But she still had very close ties to my family, was friendly to my father and my grandmother. And she would come by the house where we lived at, well, if you can call it a house, actually it was a shack. The address was 601 and a half Railroad Street, and we were right on the railroad. And I remember later years she told me, she said, you know, Greg, she said, I walked in that alley one night, and that's the only way you could get to our house was to walk through the alley. And I saw Sally, your grandmother, my grandmother, and your dad, Buster, they were both laying out there on this dirt yard, passed out drunk. And you boys were just sitting there on a plank bench waiting for him to wake up. And she said, my heart just went out to you. She said, I cannot let that continue. And so she was a domestic, and she made $25 a week. And she realized that that really wasn't enough money to support both of us. And so what she was doing in terms of inviting us up to her house to stay overnight was to decide which one of us she would take. And that I remember the night that I went up to kind of stay overnight with her, I was kind of fidgeting around in bed, apparently, and then kind of had a bad dream and woke up, and she came and calmed me and put me back to sleep or back in the bed. And then I saw her walk into her room and saw her kneel down beside her bed and start praying. And she told me that what she was doing was trying to pray to get some guidance to decide which one of us to take. But that night, she decided that she could not choose between us, that she had to take us both, no matter the fact that she only made $25 a week and just didn't have anything else, any other possibility to support us. But our need was so great, and her concern about our safety was so high that she just couldn't let us continue to live in the situation with our father and grandmother.
That's a really remarkable story.
It's incredible. She saved our lives. I would not have survived Muncie without her. And this is a woman with an eighth grade education who had absolutely nothing, but she was 52 years old when she took us in. And I think back, what is it like for a widow woman who has no money, no resources whatsoever, but is willing to take two little boys, 10 years and 8 years old, you know, just to take them in. I mean, it's just absolutely mind-boggling, the sacrifice that she made for us and willing to share everything she had with us.
My guest is Gregory Howard Williams, author of the new memoir, Life on the Color Line. He's now the dean of the Ohio State University College of Law. We'll be back after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with Gregory Howard Williams, author of the memoir, Life on the Color Line, the story of a white boy who discovered he was black. When you were coming of age, did you think of yourself as being white or being black or being biracial?
When we went back to Muncie, we were totally ostracized from the white community. I had a grandmother, a grandfather. I had a lot of aunts and uncles, and I had a lot of cousins. They pretty much ostracized us. I would see them every once in a while, but I was in classes with white cousins who would refuse to speak to me. They didn't want the other classmates to know that they were related to me. I was in the same class with black cousins, and I was embraced, and I was accepted by them. I was part of the black community. So there was never any question as to, that I was going to be white. We were always ostracized by the white community. So my self-identification was black by virtue of that experience, and that was the way it always was. That's the way everyone else identified me, and that's the way I ultimately identified myself, and I was the person that that Muncie wanted me to be.
10 years after your mother walked out on the family, she came back in, and she said that this was a good thing that her husband, her second husband, offered to give you boys his name and adopt you. What did you make of this?
Well, I made of that that this was a woman who had no foot in reality. She didn't want to talk about what had happened to us. She didn't want to know anything about how we'd lived or who we'd lived with or what we had to do to survive. When I saw her that night, it was like, did you get the milk while you're out? I just stepped out to buy some milk and some bread. And there was never any discussion of what happened in all those years. Why didn't she come and see us? Why had we been abandoned? And that we were just supposed to walk back into her lives and do what she wanted to do, and that we were supposed to jump up and down and be grateful that she was willing to walk back into our lives and be, pull us in and allow us to be adopted by her second husband, who was a very nice man. I have, nothing against him. He's very nice and a very kind person.
And he was white, and your mother is white, too, so they were also offering you the opportunity to be white again.
Right. And I'd paid too many dues then, and there's too many people that had stood beside me at times that no one would wanted to stand beside me, and even thinking about that meant that I had to abandon them and all that they meant to me, and that was a step that I was not prepared to make and would not make under any circumstances.
When you went to college and then law school, did race mean something different than it did in public school when you were there? Were there less stereotypes to contend with? Were people more just...
I think there were still a lot of stereotypes, but many of the professors that I met were a lot different than the teachers that I had met and had been my teachers in the schools in Muncie. There were more teachers who were much more interested in my own abilities and what I could do and what I could achieve as opposed to my racial background. I went back to Muncie recently and I saw one of my coaches. This was a coach who selected me as the quarterback on the football team when I was in the seventh grade. And he told me, said, "Greg, you have tremendous athletic ability, and if you continue to progress, you're going to be a football player at Muncie Central High School." And in fact, I did turn out. I was a starting quarterback on the Muncie Central football team. So he was right in that regard. But when I went back a few years ago, he said, "Greg," he said, after, I had achieved, I have 5 degrees and, a law professor and other things, he said, "Greg, I never knew you were that smart. What did you do in Muncie? Did you hide your abilities under a bushel basket?" And I just kind of laughed to myself because what was happening there, that was his perception, was colored by race. When he looked at me, even though I didn't look black, he saw this black kid and assumed that I had athletic talent, but I had no intellectual abilities. By the time I got to college, there were more teachers who were willing to look at my intellectual abilities and to be less clouded by their views about what I could or could not achieve based on my racial background.
You seem to know from a pretty young age that you wanted to be a lawyer. How did you know that?
Well, that's a good question, and I don't know. I've tried to sort that out, and I don't know whether that was really my father's dream or my dream. I think initially it was my father's dream. He had wanted to be a lawyer, and for whatever reason was not able to pursue that, and so he continued to reinforce that desire in me. But ultimately, I did embrace that dream because it seemed to me that by being a professional, or being a lawyer, I was going to be in a position to make some difference in the community, to be in a situation where I might have people listening to what I have to say and be able to have some influence in public policy decisions, although I didn't obviously articulate it in that way when I was a kid, but I felt that it gave me a certain power and influence and ability to kind of stand up and say things in my community and people would listen to me. And so that was a real goal and objective of mine from the day we walked back to Muncie, that somehow or another I wanted to change the circumstances of my life. And instead of being a person in a world over which I had absolutely no control, to at least to be able to try to control my destiny and to have some influence on what people were deciding about me and other people like me.
You're married to a woman who is white. How do your children identify racially?
Well, my children were not ostracized from the white side of their family in the way that I was. And so they know that the white side of their family, as well as the black side of their family, love them, care about them, and support them. And they're proud of their black heritage as well as their white heritage. And they feel that they have both. And that's an important thing for them. And I think that's very positive.
You know, you're the dean now of the Ohio State University College of Law. Your younger brother, who got into trouble a lot as a kid, ended up being blinded in a shooting in a bar. What's his life like now?
Well, he was shot in a bar about 20 years ago, and he's blind as a result of that shooting, and he's had a very tough life, and things have not worked out well for him. He has, however, made some remarkable strides. He is taking college. He finished high school, got his GED, and has been taking college classes. And he is he's working very hard, but unfortunately, his life has not worked out for him as well as I had hoped, or as well as he had wanted. But he has put together a life, and he has a lot of friends and companions in Indiana, and he has found an existence for him that is working.
Do you think that what we think of as race is really more a function of culture than anything else?
I think it is to a large extent, and that's what a lot of people say to me. I say, well, you don't look black. How can you be black? And I think my response to that is the issue in America has never been skin color. The issue has always been race, and the issue has been to divide society along racial lines. And if it is discovered that you have any black heritage, then in the American way to try to classify people on one side or the other, we've always tried to push on one side or the other, and as a consequence, we've not really been able to look at people as individuals and to evaluate them on their abilities and to help and assist everyone achieve all the things that they can achieve.
I want to thank you a lot for talking with us.
Thank you very much, and I appreciate the opportunity.
Gregory Howard Williams is the author of the new memoir, Life on the Color Line. Williams is the dean of the Ohio State University College of Law. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.